91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Think of the impact of the assassinations of Abraham Lincoln and John Kennedy some 100 years apart. Both presidents gained martyrdom. Presidents Garfield and McKinley also died from gunshot. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Consider how history was changed and could have been changed due to assassination and attempts. How would Reconstruction of the South have differed under Lincoln? Had Franklin Roosevelt been killed in Miami's Bayfront Park in 1932, John Nance Garner would have been in the White House. We'll visit with Florida Atlantic University professor Ronald Feynman, the author of Assassinations, Threats, and the American Presidency. That's next, First News.
The WLRN mobile app is available now for Apple and Android devices. Search WLRN in the Apple App Store or in Google Play. You'll have unlimited access to WLRN radio, live broadcasts, news stories, features, and more. The WLRN mobile app, it's free and available now.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, on our Monday edition. Bonnie, presidents and presidential candidates have encountered countless threats on their lives and numerous actual attempts. Lincoln's and JFK's are the most known assassinations, but John Garfield and William McKinley were also murdered while in office.
Huey Long Jr., Robert Kennedy were murdered as presidential candidates. Candidate Theodore Roosevelt took a bullet in 1912, yet gave a long speech immediately after. Then poor Gerald Ford.
Well, Gerald Ford had two attempts on his life, only 17 days apart. We'll now have a President's Day discussion with Florida Atlantic University history professor and author Ronald Feynman.
He's written Assassinations, Threats, and the American Presidency, from Andrew Jackson to Barack Obama. And he joins us from WXCL-TV in Boynton Beach. Welcome to you, Professor Feynman.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's our pleasure to have you. So how fortuitous for you, you were actually commissioned to write this book. How did that come about?
Well, the thing is, I've been interested in the topic of presidential assassinations and threats for many years. When I was a freshman in college more than 50 years ago, I had to do a term paper in English, and I chose the Lincoln assassination. I was fascinated by it. The following year, the Kennedy assassination took place, and then, of course, a lot of other threats and assassinations attempts occurred. And over the years, I've lectured before senior citizen and adult groups in South Florida on the topic. And Roman Littlefield, my publisher, happened to notice that I was doing a lecture locally in South Florida, and they wrote me at my Florida Atlantic University email and asked, would you like to write a book on this subject?
Wow.
So I thought, wow, I mean, I'm now retired. I still teach a bit, but I have much more free time. Why not? So I really enjoyed doing this.
Beginning the book, I was a little surprised that Andrew Jackson was really the first threatened, when you consider how difficult and controversial the presidencies of both Jefferson and Adams were.
That's true, but there's no record that we have of any president before Jackson, public record that I've been able to find, and as far as I know, nobody else has found it either. So Jackson's the only president before Abraham Lincoln to face a direct threat.
You know, we're going to get to Andrew Jackson, of course, but after researching and writing this book, do you feel reassured that enough is being done to protect presidents and prospective presidents?
Well, I think there's two ways to look at it. If you look at the history of the Secret Service, which, although it was formed in 1865, it was not formed to protect the president. It was formed to deal with counterfeit currency issues. And only in 1901, after William McKinley was the third president assassinated, Lincoln, James Garfield, and McKinley, then the Secret Service started to protect the president. And in a way, it's 115 years now since 1901. There's only been one unfortunate assassination, John F. Kennedy, and one shooting, serious shooting, Ronald Reagan. So in that sense, I could argue it's done a pretty good job. However, in recent years, there's been quite a few flubs and problems with the Secret Service, particularly under President Obama, and it has been alarming such as Omar Gonzalez leaping over the fence and entering the White House in September 2014, and more recently someone named Caputo also becoming a threat. And it indicates there needs to be reform and updating of the Secret Service.
So Barack Obama, really by a wide margin, has had more threats than any other president in the country, correct?
Except for maybe Abraham Lincoln. We believe Lincoln may have had war total. But yes, certainly in modern times. But the number of threats has been growing since the time of Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and since then.
In Obama's case, would you think that's racially motivated?
I think sometimes it is. Some of the cases, based on what I've published, yes. I think others, it's just people that have mental illness, unfortunately, and want notoriety and infamy or fame. But I do think race certainly is shown by a number of the cases to be an issue, yes, unfortunately.
And do politics, I mean, are politics ever behind some of these attempts or assassinations? I'm thinking of Robert Kennedy, maybe.
Yes, absolutely. I think politics, also sometimes religion, sometimes economics. But I think most of the assassins or potential assassins, with maybe the exception of John Wilkes Booth, have mental illness issues. And that is a real problem in our society and always has been.
In reading your book, it made me wonder how many attempts or threats have been posed to presidents or candidates that we haven't heard about or that you couldn't even uncover because they've been kept secret.
Well, I think a lot of things have been kept secret. The Secret Service, you know, we know there's many attempts, but honestly, you can't find as many attempts as they indicate there are. So unless it's really serious or somehow it gets, you know, public notice, they try to avoid telling us too much. And that's the thing that makes me wonder about Dwight D. Eisenhower and Lyndon Johnson, because there's no public record of any attempts on them. And yet, I don't know if I really believe that, but I could not find anything on either LBJ or Ike.
Of course, Johnson was trying to push through a very controversial civil rights bill.
Yes, and also the Vietnam War.
And the Vietnam War.
Yeah, I'm amazed, but there's no public record that I'm aware of or been able to find of any threats. I'm sure there were, and I'm sure with Eisenhower as well, but I was unable to find. But every other president since Franklin D. Roosevelt has had threats.
Well, we're very familiar with the assassinations of Lincoln and, of course, JFK. And we don't want to get into conspiracy problems about the actual event with Kennedy. I'll forewarn our callers.
Well, there's also a conspiracy theory on the Sirhan, on Robert F. Kennedy.
Yes, of course. But fill us in on John Garfield. And
James Garfield.
James Garfield, perhaps the most intelligent presidency.
Yes, James Garfield was only in office a few months. He knew many languages. He had been a college president. He had many different abilities. I think he might have been, of course, we don't know, might have been the best president after Lincoln until Teddy Roosevelt. But he was shot by an office seeker, Charles Guiteau, 4 months after after the inauguration. And actually, Guiteau had been stalking him and actually meeting with him a few times earlier, trying to get a government job. And he was obviously mentally ill, and it was such a sad thing. And the treatment, medical treatment, was atrocious, and he suffered for almost 80 days and then died in September after 6.5 months. But it was really a tragedy of major proportions.
What year was that?
1881. And 100 years later, Reagan, although seriously wounded, was saved. But if it had been 1881, not 1981, I think Reagan would have ended up the same as Garfield. The medical profession was not up to date and did not know about germs and about x-rays. And they just did not know how to deal with Garfield's wounds, and they didn't remove the bullet. They couldn't find it.
And what was the fate of his assassin?
He was put on trial, put on quite a show at his trial, danced around the room singing a falsetto voice, like a ballerina dancer. I wish I could go back and see it, just to see it. And then he was executed in 1882.
Getting back to Andrew Jackson, because there's a really interesting thing about him.
Yes.
The attempt on Andrew Jackson. I was really surprised to learn that it was the father of John Wilkes Booth who wrote a threatening letter.
Yes, Junius Brutus Booth, himself a famous actor, and before John Wilkes Booth's birth, actually wrote a threatening letter that's been authenticated. That's all it was, however. But there's also, of course, the, you know, the case of Richard Lawrence, who 2 years, well, the same year, 1835, actually fired two pistols at Jackson outside the U.S. Capitol building after a funeral, and both misfired, and the odds of that are astronomical, that it would not have harmed him. And he actually had his walking cane, Jackson, because, you know, he had health issues, and he whacked Richard Lawrence over the head and subdued his own assassin.
Well, of course, Jackson had been a duelist and a pretty rough character.
Yeah, he had killed some people in gun duels, yeah, but that must have been a scene to see him subdue his own assassin, or attempted assassin.
It's kind of interesting that he was, let's see, what, the seventh?
Seventh president.
Yeah,
yes.
And it's interesting, as Joe mentioned, about a couple of others, that there were no attempts prior to that.
Not that we have a record of, no. Hmm. Maybe it'll come about someday, we might, but if it is, I'll write another book.
Yeah, right. So let's move on to McKinley. What happened to him?
McKinley was in his second term, and this is an interesting story because his first term vice president was Garrett Hobart of New Jersey, and they were very close, the first lady, the second lady, and the presidents. But in 1899, he died of heart troubles, and there was no vice president for the remainder of the term. So for his second term, he chose Theodore Roosevelt, the hero of the Spanish-American War. And 6 months into the term, Teddy Roosevelt's president, when it could have been President Hobart. So I have a list of 15 might-have-been presidents, and Garrett Hobart is one of them who might have been if he had not died, but instead Teddy Roosevelt is. Now, as far as McKinley, he's shot by an anarchist, and I guess we would call that modern terrorism, Leon Jogues, and he is mortally wounded. And again, the medical care is not very good. They thought he would get better, but they did not remove the bullet. You know, and all that. I still can't quite understand why they weren't unable to somehow to locate it. And he died after 8 days.
Why wouldn't they? Do they have X-rays yet?
X-rays with just the bare bones beginning, and they seem to not be able to locate the bullet. It's astounding. And the thing that's interesting also is McKinley is shot on September 6th, 1901, and 8 days later he dies, and it's the first year of the century, and suddenly the presidency is transformed by Teddy Roosevelt, as it turns out, and then you add 100 years and take away 3 days, and you got September 11th, 2001, a transformational event, almost the exact same day on the same year, a century apart, which is fascinating in itself.
We're speaking with Florida Atlantic University history professor and author Ronald Fineman. We're talking about his book, Assassinations, Threats, and the American Presidency. We're going to take a short break and be back with more. And it's Topical Currents Monday edition. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman and Professor Ronald Fineman. We're talking about his book, Assassinations, Threats, and the American Presidency, from Andrew Jackson to Barack Obama. Ronald Fineman, Bonnie and I are sitting at Northeast 14th Street, close to Biscayne Boulevard, just above downtown Miami. We're only about a mile away from Bayfront Park. Tell us of the events of 1932, December.
Well, actually, it was 1933, February, is actually. It's 17 days before the inauguration. The inauguration was still March 4th in 1933. And FDR had been elected, but he was president-elect, and he was at a Democratic Party gathering in Miami Bayfront Park on February 15th, 1933. Again, 17 days to the inauguration. And a crowd comes to see the president-elect, and there's a whole group of Democratic Party bigwigs there.
Did you say February 15th?
Yeah, February 15th, 1933.
So it's an anniversary today.
Oh, no, you're right.
I just realized that.
Yes, and that would make it 83 years ago. Wow, I hadn't thought of that. That's very perceptive. That's true. Yes, today, the day, yes. On this day, FDR, of course, we know could not walk. He was sitting in his car. And near him, well, next to him, was the mayor of Chicago, Anton Cermak. And we had a Italian immigrant named Giuseppe Zangara, also known as Joseph Zangara, who fired a bullet or fired bullets at FDR, but his hand was knocked by someone in the crowd, and it ended up shooting and mortally wounding Mayor Cermak, and he died about 2 weeks later. And Cermak is famous for the fact that on the way to the hospital in the ambulance, and FDR's with him, that he says, "Better me than you." Mm. And there's apparently, I haven't seen it personally, but apparently there is a monument or something in the park that says that quote.
Yes.
And I thought, wow, you're awfully generous.
So, but tell us what happened. So FDR was okay.
Yes.
But what happened to Zangaro?
That's really an amazing case. First of all, he was brought up for assault on Cermak. Cermak did not die right away. He was convicted and sentenced to, I think, 80 years in prison or something like that. And then when Cermak died, he was quickly brought up, you know, for murder, and he was convicted, had a very quick, appeal, extremely quick, and he was executed 5 weeks after the events.
Do we know if he got a fair trial?
I have my doubts, really. I do think so.
Because that's pretty quick to...
Yes. There's March 20th, I think, was the day he was executed. This was Florida Justice in 1933, unfortunately.
There's a book by Fort Lauderdale attorney Blaise Peachy who covers this event in detail. I had him on many years ago, so that's why I maybe messed up the date. But wasn't Roosevelt actually... He'd been out on a yacht with some, like one of the Astors or somebody, a real high roller, and then came into the port of Miami.
That's correct.
And then he was attacked there.
Yes, but fortunately he was not hurt. Had he been killed, Speaker of the House, now Vice President-elect John Nance Garner from Texas, would have been president, and I feel that Garner would not have promoted what became the New Deal of FDR. He was an isolationist in 1940 when he challenged FDR when he was running for a third term and, of course, did not get the nomination. I think it would have been a tragedy in the White House, quite frankly.
Wait a minute. You're saying Speaker of the House would have been president?
Well, he had been Speaker of the House. He was elected president.
Okay.
So he was Speaker of the House until the inauguration when he was vice president, yes.
Well, let's talk about the succession laws of the presidency because they've changed.
Yes, there's been three succession laws. The original one is 1792. Interestingly, from 89 to 92, there's no succession law under George Washington other than the vice president for some reason. But then in 1792, the order of succession after the vice president is the president pro tempore of the Senate, then the Speaker of the House, and then the cabinet members, starting with Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of War, as they called it then, not defense, and Attorney General, and even Postmaster General was in the line of succession. Now, that was in effect when Lincoln was killed and Andrew Johnson, his vice president, was supposed to be killed but was not. So if Andrew Johnson had been killed when Lincoln was in 1865, the president pro tempore of the Senate, Senator Lafayette Foster of Connecticut, a real sort of like, I really had to dig for that person to find him. Mm. I think I rehabilitated his name, brought him to life. He would have been president.
And, of course, the Secretary of State was attacked the same night.
Yes, Seward was attacked, yes.
And Andrew Johnson was supposed to be killed also?
Yes, and had he been, Lafayette Foster would have been president. Now, if Lincoln had not changed his vice president from Hannibal Hamlin, his first term vice president, Hamlin would still have been vice president, and assuming he hadn't been killed, he would have been president. So these are two more might-have-beens among the possible presidents.
Well, I want to go back. Joe went to FDR, but I want to go to Teddy, because that's a really great story. Tell us what happened to him.
Well, actually, there's two cases. One that I uncovered when he was president, and he was at home in Oyster Bay, Sagamore Hill, and Henry Weilbrenner came up to visit him one evening without an appointment. The Secret Service had started to protect the president in 1901, and this is September 1st, 1903. And, you know, they asked him, do you have an appointment? No. Well, the president cannot see you. He leaves. He comes back. This is in the evening. A second and a third time, they check him out finally and discover he has firearms on him. So in theory, he was a threat, although he never got to see Teddy Roosevelt. That's the unknown story that I uncovered by doing research. But I guess the more famous one is, as a former president, TR's running as a progressive Boo Moose Party third-party nominee in 1912, and actually will do the best third-party performance ever, winning six states and 88 electoral votes. But anyway, while he's running, he's in Milwaukee, and he is shot by John Flaming Schrank, and yet insists he's only slightly wounded because he has his 50-page speech in his shirt pocket, and he has his steel glass case in his jacket, and it just grazes him. He's bleeding, but he insists he's got to give his speech first before he goes to the hospital. He speaks for 80 minutes while he's bleeding. Amazing. And then he goes to the hospital. They do not remove the bullets, but they decide he can live with it. But I think it undermines his health, and I think it may have contributed to his death only 6.5 years later at age 60.
And what happened to his would-be assassin?
John Flaming Schrank was sentenced to a mental hospital And he stayed there the rest of his life. And the famous story is not one person visited him all the years until his death in 1943.
I'm wondering why Zangaro was executed and why other people got such... I'm thinking of Gerald Ford and...
Well, I think the difference is Gerald Ford's two women, the only two cases, two women, 17 days apart in September 75, Lynette Squeaky Frome and Sarah Jane Moore, they both shot at the president, but he was not wounded, and I think that's the reason for that, and the same reason why I think Sirhan Sirhan has been in prison for nearly 50 years because he killed Robert Kennedy. There's a difference.
Right, but you would think, why wasn't he executed?
Because that's California.
Yeah.
Well, it's different. The death penalty was deleted
then.
Southern justice, especially back then, was much tougher and probably still is.
Still is, probably.
Yeah.
Ronald Fineman, speaking of women and presidential assassinations, how about the case of Mary Surratt and the Lincoln assassination?
Sure.
She ran the boarding house where Booth stayed and one of the other conspirators or two of the others, and she was hanged.
Yes,
Should she have been hanged?
Yeah, she was hanged. There was a lot of controversy that she was hanged, and I think probably it was wrong to have done that. But she was hanged because it was said she was involved in a conspiracy and had given them a place to meet and to conspire and plan.
Has any weapon other than a firearm ever been used in an attempt or in an assassination?
Well, I guess you could say there's a case of Samuel Bike, B-Y-C-K, who wanted to kill Richard Nixon in February 1974. Never got near Nixon. But the fact is he tried to hijack a plane in the Baltimore-Washington airport, was unable to do so. His plan was to fly the plane from the Baltimore-Washington airport, hit the White House. Now, it turns out Nixon wasn't in the building that day, but to hit the building, this would have been September 11th, 27 years earlier, if it had occurred.
Oh, my.
Amazing story. And it was well hidden until recent years when it was finally covered by the History Channel and also a movie, The Assassination of Richard Nixon, with Sean Penn playing Samuel Bike. And I remember when the film came out, I said, huh? Assassination of? Because I hadn't been aware of it before that.
Seems like a portentous day, September 11th, all around.
Well, because we could have, in February 22, we could have had September 11th way ahead of September 11th, yeah.
Right. So let's move along to Huey Long. Tell us about him.
Huey Long was, of course, considered by some a fascist, by others a socialist in an extreme way. He had his own group of followers in Louisiana. He had been governor of the state and been considered radical in his approach to issues. He talked about every man a king, sharing the wealth. This is the middle of the Great Depression. He was critical of FDR not doing enough in the New Deal. And he was seen as theoretically a threat to FDR's reelection. I don't think he really was, but he was not yet fully announced, but he was campaigning because he was going to announce his candidacy. And he ends up supposedly, although it's still debatable, killed by a medical doctor, Dr. Carl Austin Weiss, whose father-in-law was a judge who Huey Long was trying to remove from the state bench. And yet, it's not clear because the son of Dr. Carl Austin Weiss spent his life, and I'm not sure if he's still alive, trying to defend his father. But the fact is, when it was said that he opened up fire on Long at the Louisiana State Capitol in Baton Rouge, the state troopers, some people call them stormtroopers, that were there as bodyguards for Huey Long, opened up fire and shot Weiss full of 61 bullets. Mm. And some people think that they either accidentally or plot, they might have killed Huey Long themselves. So it's still a debatable issue with Dr. Carl Austin Weiss.
There were some kind of feelings that perhaps the guards had been gathered so closely around Long that people couldn't tell that he'd actually been shot and that it was an inside job.
Yes, and certainly his medical care in the hospital for 2 days, he died 2 days later, Huey Long, was a sign of not very well taken care of. So some people think there might have been a plot to, kill him even when he was wounded.
We're talking to Professor Ronald L. Fineman, and he's written Assassinations, Threats, and the American Presidency, from Andrew Jackson to Barack Obama. If you have questions or comments, except about the JFK conspiracy.
Well, I don't accept the conspiracy theory.
No grassy knolls, please.
Right. Yeah. You can call us 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email radio@wlrn.org. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman on this Monday afternoon. 33 minutes past 1 o'clock, we return with Florida Atlantic University history professor and author Ronald Fineman. We're talking about his book, Assassinations, Threats, and the American Presidency, from Andrew Jackson to Barack Obama. Again, if you'd like to join in, that's easy enough. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. Or email, that's radio@wlrn.org.
Professor, why your fascination with this subject, the presidential assassinations, the threats? You have every date down pat.
Hey, you're not getting any funny ideas, are you, Professor?
No, not at all. Although I must say I've written some articles on thehill.com and also History News Network, hnn.us, concerned about the threat of assassination with all the rhetoric and invective, you know, that's going around this year. I think there is danger, and that's why Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders and also Ben Carson and, of course, Hillary Clinton have protection, because I do think, you know, this is a very divided country, and there is always that threat, as with Robert Kennedy, Huey Long, and George Wallace, of course, who we haven't mentioned, who was shot and paralyzed for life.
Right. Do you want to go to him next?
Yeah, George Wallace, of course, was a segregationist, highly divisive figure who, in 1968, ran on a third party line, and actually had the second best performance to Teddy Roosevelt in 1912. He won 5 states instead of 6, like T.R., and he won 46 electoral votes rather than 88. Now, of course, he couldn't win. Third party candidates cannot win, but he still took quite a few votes away. And certainly probably harmed Hubert Humphrey and helped Richard Nixon indirectly. But 4 years later, he was shot at a Laurel, Maryland shopping center by Arthur Bremmer. And the interesting story about Arthur Bremmer, who's the youngest assassin, 21, or attempted assassin, is that he was stalking Richard Nixon earlier. So the theory is, if he had indeed shot Nixon and killed him earlier, it's possible Spiro Agnew, his vice president, would have been president. So that's another might have been. And if I may go back, go forward with Ronald Reagan. He is, of course, shot by John Hinckley. And we now know that Hinckley stalked Jimmy Carter months earlier in 1980 during the campaign. So let's, God forbid, say Carter had been killed, Walter Mondale would have been president. And possibly the election of 1980, with sympathy for Carter's death, Mondale coming in a month before, might have led to Mondale defeating Reagan, and we never would have had Ronald Reagan.
My, all of these might have been.
Same with FDR and TR.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay, so, and also, speaking about the George Wallace, you have that picture in there, which was pretty stunning. Talk about that in the book.
Yes, I found that, you know, and I decided I was going to use it. It's a picture of Ethel Kennedy, Robert Kennedy's widow, visiting George Wallace in the hospital after he was shot and paralyzed for life. And it's a very touching picture, because 4 years earlier, she had lost her husband. And even though Robert Kennedy and George Wallace had nothing in common politically, it was still, you know, the commiseration about the threat of being a public official and facing a possible threat, as today people like Trump and Sanders do face.
It would have been interesting to have been a fly on the wall in that room.
Yes, absolutely. I've always wished I could go back and be in the scenes, but, you know, but not part of it.
Right, right. Exactly.
Let's take a telephone call or two. First up, we have Doug. Doug is in Miami. Hi.
Hi there. Of all the successful assassinations you've written about, which do you think was the most consequential?
Oh, that's an easy answer. I know people think Kennedy, John F. Kennedy. No, it's Abraham Lincoln, because Abraham Lincoln's death led to Andrew Johnson, who was rated either the bottom or second from the bottom. Depends if you decide James Buchanan is worse than him, the president before, or Johnson, the president after Lincoln. I think Johnson is the worst. I think he was a true disaster. Hannibal Hamlin would have been better, or Lafayette Foster, if they had come in, I believe. But on the other hand, with John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson followed the Kennedy program domestically and promoted the Great Society, and he did more than Kennedy might have done, but, you know, that's usually seen as positive. by most people. Vietnam, hard to say, but there's no indication that Kennedy would have withdrawn. So I think LBJ followed JFK, so it was not as tragic as in the case of Andrew Johnson following Abraham Lincoln. I think Lincoln is still the most consequential assassination in history.
And what about, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to follow up. Do you think that all that legislation could have passed under the Johnson administration without the sympathy after the Kennedy assassination?
I think it's both. I think it's partly, you know, yes, the sympathy, but also LBJ was the greatest legislative artist there ever was, the Wheeler Dealer. I think it's a combination of both. I do certainly say the sympathy helped. Plus, he had his own party in control, of course. If you don't have your party in control, you can't get things done. So it was a very good time for the Democratic Party at that point.
Professor, let me go back
Thank you for your question.
To what you were talking about with Arthur Bremer. He stalked Nixon. Had he killed Nixon and Agnew had become president, this was before Agnew's corruption allegations
right.
in Maryland had come up. So if he had been had to resign the presidency because of those allegations, who was then president of the Senate at the time? Obviously a Democrat.
Well, actually, we didn't finish that issue of the succession laws. I realized somehow we got diverted.
Right.
I wanted to point out that first succession law, president pro tempore, then Speaker of the House, the Secretary of State, etc., is the law into 1886. Then it's changed to be the cabinet members after the vice president. So it was it would be Secretary of State, Treasury, War, Attorney General. Then in 1947, it was changed to the present law, which is the Speaker of the House, the president pro tempore
right, so
of the Senate.
Of the House.
And then, yeah, so the Speaker of the House at that time was Carl Albert, who, of
right,
course,
okay.
would have been president if there wasn't a 25th Amendment that allowed Nixon to pick Gerald Ford to replace Agnew. So Carl Albert could have been president, yes. Although I don't mention him as a case because of the 25th Amendment.
And who was he?
Carl Albert was the Speaker of the House.
Right, but what party was he?
A Democrat. Oklahoma, which also is a problem with this law. 3 out of 4 years since 1947, the Speaker of the House and or usually both, the President pro tempore of the Senate are the party opposite the President. And that's why if I had my way, I would go back to the second law, 1886 to 1947, meaning these cabinet members should be directly in line, not the Speaker and not the President pro tempore. But that's not the law now.
Why do you think they changed it?
It was the Republican Party gaining control after years in the wilderness, and Truman, you know, president with no vice president for the remainder of that term, no 25th Amendment yet, and they wanted to ensure that if Truman somehow, you know, did not finish his term, that the Speaker of the House, Joseph Martin, who's on my list as possible presidents, 15 might have been, would have been the president. So it is a Republican ploy, and it's the law ever since.
Oh, my.
Let's move along to another caller, Steve in Miami. Hi there.
Following your line there real quick, I love these what might have been things, too. But the whole thing with the succession, don't you think that maybe the reason they made it the way it was so that you did not wind up with somebody that was a completely non-elected official holding one of the highest elected offices in the land?
That's a good question. Thank you for the question. Well, it's true the Speaker of the House is elected by one district of 435. That's just one district. The President pro tempore is the senior member of the Senate in service of the majority party. He's elected by a state. That's true. That is true while cabinet members are not. But cabinet members, I argue, offer continuity if a president and vice president are not available. While the other way, it can change things dramatically if the other party, either way, you know, it's been both ways, comes in. But I can see your point, yes.
Okay, if I may throw in one other thing. And
sure.
I know you want to stay away from the Kennedy thing. It always kills me because these people just go too crazy. Because I'm a firm believer that Lee Harvey Oswald shot Kennedy. Jack Ruby shot him, and it was because they were both just crazy. But my part of the conspiracy would probably be that us being in the height of the Cold War, the Russians took that information at that time and basically tried to undermine the country's confidence in their government by helping perpetuate all of the conspiracy theories.
So that's a conspiracy about the conspiracy.
That's
yeah, exactly. I mean, there was never a conspiracy, but they just helped to undermine the public.
And what's the conspiracy behind that one?
That's not covered by Vincent Bugliosi in his massive work on conspiracies, where he rips apart every conspiracy theory. So I don't know how to answer you on that.
Okay, Steve, we have to run.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Professor David in North Miami Beach asks, if you cover the grenade thrown at George W. Bush.
You mean the shoe?
I thought it was a shoe. I guess he means the shoe.
Yes,
in West.
Yes, I do mention it in the chapter that's the two 21st century presidents. Not much to say about it, but, you know, people laugh at it, but it's still not something to laugh at. You know, it's still a possible could harm the president. It's not a big deal, but I do mention it in my chapter, yes.
1-800-743-9576. Next up, we have a Kendall caller. This is TJ in Kendall.
Hi, Professor Feynman. I was wondering if you could elaborate at all about how the assassination of Garfield by Guiteau seeking a civil service exacerbated the tension between the half-breeds and the stalwarts and changed the character of the Republican Party in the latter part of the 1800s.
Well, I'll tell you, Garfield, it's a very good question. Garfield, I think, was a reform-oriented Republican in the time of the Gilded Age. He may have been elected by a bit of sort of like corruption of the Republican Party at that time, but I think he wanted to really bring civil service reform about, and it was brought about by his successor, Chester Alan Arthur, who was then rewarded with the party saying, sorry, you cannot be nominated for a full term. But actually, that worked out well, because if Arthur had been nominated for a full term and been elected, he would have died in office, as he did in 1886. So actually, it was probably better. But yes, I think Garfield and the civil service reform movement did start to have an effect, and I think it did help to lead to change, finally, under Teddy Roosevelt. But again, Teddy Roosevelt wouldn't have been there if Garrett Hobart hadn't died in the first term of McKinley. So a lot of this is coincidence, I think.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
Did JFK have any other brushes with?
Yes,
he did. Okay.
Yes, particularly one when he was president-elect. Here's another case where he might never have been inaugurated, like FDR. Richard Paul Pavlik in Palm Beach in Florida. You know, he had a state Kennedy there. He had a car laden with dynamite. He was the oldest possible assassin, and I think he was 71. Arthur Brem is the youngest, 21. And, you know, he was planning to blow himself up with the car right near Kennedy and all that. The Secret Service seems to have been a little lax. And he was planning to do it one day in December 1960, which was after the election but before the inauguration. Mm-hmm. But he saw JFK with Jackie and with Caroline, and he seemed to have a soft moment, like, I don't want to do this to them, just want to do it to the president. So he didn't do anything about it that day. But he hung around, and the Secret Service started to notice this guy hanging around with a car. And then they investigated and discovered, oh, my gosh, what could have been.
And what happened to him?
He was put into prison for about 6 years, and then I think he was released. You know, he was really like high 70s by the time he was released. But that was pretty scary. So we could have been without Teddy Roosevelt, without JFK, without Reagan, and without FDR, in theory.
All right, and we have more to cover that we haven't even gotten to, threats.
Yes.
Okay, we're speaking with Professor Ronald Feynman. He's also he teaches at Florida Atlantic University. He teaches 20th century American history, and he's written Assassinations, Threats, and the American Presidency. Our last break, we'll be right back.
And we return with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're talking about presidential assassinations, attempts, and threats with Professor Ronald Feynman of FAU. Professor, why don't you touch for a short time on the only Secret Service agent who was killed in the defense of a president and the circumstances surrounding that?
Sure. That's the Truman attempt in 1950 on November 1st. Two Puerto Rican nationalists who wanted to see Puerto Rico become independent from the United States, indeed decided they were going to try to kill President Truman and possibly his wife, who were living at Blair House then, because the White House was under renovation. And indeed, they never got near him. But interestingly, Truman looked out the window and was told to get back, because he was watching the scene. And these two Puerto Rican nationalists were Oscar Collazo and Gracilio Torresola. And Torresola was killed, Collazo was injured, and he served time in prison until he was pardoned by Jimmy Carter in 1979. But Leslie Kofelt was a Secret Service agent who was killed in what was like a three-minute gun battle, and is the only Secret Service agent, others have been wounded, but the only one ever killed And he was buried in Arlington National Cemetery.
Why would they have ever thought that killing Truman and perhaps his wife would gain them independence of the U.S.?
Well, because they were extremists in their viewpoint. And the thing is, I think the sister of one of them had been injured in a riot or like an uprising in Puerto Rico, the Jiuya uprising, which was not much reported at the time. It was quite a radical uprising, and the military really cracked down on it, and they were furious because of the injury of one of their sisters, and they just decided that the U.S. government was imperialist, and this is before Puerto Rico became a commonwealth, so it was a hot issue.
And we move along. Next caller up, it's Stanley in Coral Gables. Hi there.
Hi. I'm looking forward to reading your book, Professor.
Thank you.
But I have a question. At the same time, approximately the same time as the attempt to assassinate Roosevelt, there was an attempt to have a coup against him by a group called the Liberty League, which was broken up by a Marine general named Smedley Butler.
Smedley Butler, yes. That's true. And this
Are they related?
Related in what way?
Was the Liberty League involved with this guy?
Zangara?
Oh, Zangara.
Yeah.
No indication, because they were considered a right-wing group, and if anything, Zangara would be considered a left-wing type of person, I would say. But, the whole movement of the so-called business plot, it's better known as, in 1934, never really got off the ground. It was more a conspiracy in the sense of people thinking maybe we could find a way to get rid of FDR, not kill him, but remove him from office, have a coup because he was a socialist, they said, or a communist or a Marxist because of the New Deal. And what's interesting is it was pretty much covered up, but there's evidence that a lot of big business people were involved in some way, at least discussing the idea, not saying they got further than that. And this includes members of Henry Ford and the Rockefeller family and General Motors and other big corporations. And it's controversial and it's not accepted by everybody, but there seems to be hints that the father of President George H.W. Bush and the grandfather of Jeb and George W. Bush, that is Prescott Bush, later a senator from Connecticut, may have been involved in some of this planning. So it seems from the evidence I've found, but I don't know if it's conclusive. I mentioned it, but I'm not sure that we know it's final and conclusive. But there are books that have been written about the Bush family that indicates a lot of problems in their background, further back, including that Prescott Bush had dealings with Adolf Hitler in the late 30s, supposedly. Anyway.
Also, Professor, when you mentioned that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and you said Dr. Carson.
And Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders does have. I didn't know if you included him. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And another caller. This is Adam in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hi, Professor. It's a very interesting topic. And
thank you.
First of all, what is the full name of your book, and when is it available?
It's available since August. It's published by Roman Littlefield. If you go on the website of Roman Littlefield, you can get it for 30% off up to July 31st. If not, you can go on Amazon or on Books A Million or on BarnesandNoble.com.
Is this your cousin Adam on the air?
No, this is no relation.
Or, of course, you can always go to an independent bookseller like Books and Books.
Yes. And I'm still missing the title. I'm sorry.
Okay, Assassinations, Threats, and the American Presidency, from Andrew Jackson to Barack Obama. And you can always look it up on Amazon for the full information and the reviews.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The second question is I'm going to get to that pretty quick, but there's been a ton of movies on assassinations, everything from, the Manchurian Candidate to In the Line of Fire with Clint Eastwood. First of all, I'm curious about whether you've liked any of them, what your favorites are, and also, I remember when I was a kid watching an episode of The Twilight Zone, someone goes back in time to try to stop John Wilkes Booth from killing Lincoln. It was a chilling episode back in the day.
I'm curious
if you've ever seen that. And again, thank you for your time. I'm just going to hang up and listen.
Okay. Yes. Thanks so much, Adam.
I'm not an expert on assassination films, to be honest. But I do think that the Manchurian Candidate is very original. Manchurian Candidate is fascinating. And actually, one of the defenses of Sirhan Sirhan is that he may have been indeed set up in his brain to take action and didn't know what he was doing, that he was a Manchurian candidate against Robert Kennedy. That's what's been said anyway. But
What is his status today? Where is he?
He's still in prison after 47 years, and he's having his 11th, I think it's 11th time he's coming up for parole. He's had a longer time in prison than anybody has ever killed anyone, you know, a political candidate. And, you know, I think it's because he killed him. If he had wounded him, or he hadn't, you know, like with the Gerald Ford cases, or even Ronald Reagan's case, John Hinckley, he didn't kill Reagan. So he has half the month out every month that he could be with his mother, you know, who's 90 years old or so. And Nancy Reagan's against it, and I'm against him being
free. He gets
free.
To leave 2 weeks a month?
Yeah, he has an ankle bracelet, you know, and the people trail him. But he's able to go out and go to Wendy's, I've read, and go to bookstores. And I think it's strange, and I think Nancy Reagan's right in that it shouldn't be that way. But he is, because, again, he didn't kill President Reagan.
Professor, in recorded history in Europe, besides the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand, have there been meaningful European assassinations?
Well, go back to Julius Caesar, right?
Well, I mean in modern times.
Well, I mean, not so. I'm just trying to think. Well, certainly in Asia. I mean, like the Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi was assassinated. But you know, Benazir Bhutto, the leader of Pakistan. At the moment, I'm trying to think that not any that stick out in my mind at the moment, but. But, I mean, assassination has always, going back to Julius Caesar, been a factor in history, of course. And I mentioned that in my first chapter or introduction.
Were there any attempts on President Clinton or the first President Bush?
Oh, absolutely. And I do have them in the book. And, in fact, the ones on Clinton were fairly serious. One of them involved a person who landed a small plane on the White House grounds.
Oh.
Frank Eugene Corder, September 12, 1994. There was also a case when he was in the Philippines at a conference in 1996, and they got information that a bridge that his entourage was going to go over had been set up to be dynamited, and he went a different way. And it turns out, who was setting up that dynamite on that bridge? Osama bin Laden.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Well, we just have a couple of minutes left. I just wanted to ask you, I know that it's not, you teach the presidency, but political history also.
Yes.
And it's not what we're discussing, but I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about the death of Associate Supreme Court Justice Scalia and the debate. Do you have any questions about, somebody wrote this, and I did hear there was a pillow over his head, if you have any theories about that?
You mean, well, as far as the idea that he was murdered, that's starting to show up in the extremist camp,
right,
that he was murdered by orders of the president, which is preposterous. It really is. But I do think, you know, he was a transformational figure, whether you liked him or not. He really transformed the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia. And I do think that there is the right to have a replacement this year. Possibly have a you know, a person who agrees to be there only for 1 year just to keep the court going. There could be maybe an arrangement made for that. That might be a compromise. But certainly, I do not think we should have the Supreme Court with only 8 members for more than a year. It's never happened. The longest wait ever for a successful nominee is 125 days for Louis Brandeis in 1916, appointed by Woodrow Wilson. And a lot of it was anti-Semitism that held it up. And the longest of a case of a justice nominee who was not approved was Robert Bork, 114 days in 1987. This would be over a year because the new president cannot nominate until he's inaugurated. So it means 342 days and then time added on until, so I think there should be a replacement, yes. And I think Scalia, his death could transform the court to a liberal majority, and it has been a Republican court majority since 1972, so it's transformational.
Well, we want to thank Ronald L. Feynman, professor, PhD. He's an author, professor of history at FAU, Florida Atlantic University. He also has a website, theprogressiveprofessor.com. He's written Assassinations, Threats, and the American Presidency from Andrew Jackson to Barack Obama. Thank you so much.
Thank you again so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
We did too.
And apologies to those callers. We couldn't get on the air. Our program was produced by Richard Ive. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. Free audio archives of this and all our programs you can pick from our website, WLRN.org, and more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow, Bonnie and I come back with more. We'll take on the issues around long-term care insurance, then have a literary bent with contributor Ariel Gonzalez of Miami-Dade College. We'll learn more about a novel which takes place in Miami, during the tumultuous 1972 political conventions, Miami Beach.
And we want to thank WXEL for their cooperation today.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.